Welcome to Authorial Intentions, a series of conversations about recently published or forthcoming books by faculty in Vanderbilt University's Divinity School and Graduate Department of Religion. I'm Chris Benda, theological librarian at Vanderbilt University's Divinity Library, and today I'll be talking with Len Goodman, professor of philosophy and Andrew W. Mellon professor in the humanities, about the recent book celebrating his work, and the title of the book is Len E. Goodman, Judaism, Humanity, and Nature. It was edited by Hava Tirosh Samuelson and Aaron W. Hughes. Len, it's good to talk with you
again. It's really a pleasure to be with you and talk about that book. I'm hugely honored by the appearance of such a thing.
Yes, and I want to say congratulations.
Well, thank you.
For having a book produced in your honor. And I wanted to start by asking you a question that actually sort of comes out of the title of the series that this book is a part of. The book is part of the series, The Library of Contemporary Jewish Philosophers. And the description of the series that's on the back cover of the book indicates that it showcases outstanding Jewish thinkers who have made lasting contributions to constructive Jewish philosophy in the second half of the 20th century and the early 21st century. So my first question is a tiny one. What is Jewish philosophy, and what does it mean what does it mean to be a Jewish philosopher?
Well, I'm really glad you asked that, Chris, because Jewish philosophy is a very old tradition, of course, but it has come and gone through the ages. Different historical circumstances and different exiles, persecutions, and so forth. My feeling is, historically, when Jews get a respite, there's an opportunity to ask the big questions. Maimonides, who was one of the great Jewish philosophers of the Middle Ages, says people can't really deal with those questions when they're very hungry, very sick, very cold. But when we have a chance, we're interested in those questions. And I think the questions that Jewish philosophy deals with are the same questions that general philosophy deals with, about the nature of being, man's experience, the role in the world, ethics and knowledge, and all of the general questions that philosophers care about. What makes philosophy Jewish is the continuity of a tradition where you can draw on different texts that address those questions, very often in different idioms, sometimes in poetry, sometimes in dialogue or drama, like you have in the book of Job, let's say, sometimes in a fictional form, or sometimes by bringing out important features of some episode, or using figures to personify or typify great issues or great problems, as Abraham does. The distinctive thing about Jewish philosophy is the themes which it finds in human experience, the meanings that it discovers in the human drama. And that's something which has come to life once again in our own time. The tendency in Jewish studies, let's say for the first half of the 20th century, roughly, a lot of the work was very descriptive and very historicist. People thought that the Jewish philosophy was something that you could read about. It was a body of texts that you could discover. But there was a reticence, partly because of the dominance of positivism and other forms of scientific thinking in the first half of the 20th century and beyond, to try to bracket that experience and talk about it clinically. Mm. I think now people have screwed up their courage and tried to address those questions in our own person. And so we've seen a remarkable revival. When I started doing Jewish philosophy, when I wrote my book on justice, and the publishers at Yale University Press told me, oh, this is a really modern book. I wanted to call it On Justice, and they said, you should call it something about, bring out the fact that it has Jewish content in it. It's not just another book about justice. It's about justice that looks at that issue from a Jewish standpoint and dealing with Jewish themes and Jewish texts, which have something important and distinctive to say about that. And so I agreed to call it On Justice, An Essay in Jewish Philosophy. Mm. And when I published that book back in the 80s, there was only a handful of people doing constructive Jewish philosophy. We had a little group. We used to meet from time to time, coming from different campuses and different continents. Today, we can say happily that library of living Jewish philosophy, contemporary Jewish philosophies that you mentioned, mm-hmm. It's going to have 20 volumes in it.
Okay.
And there are lots more people coming into that field, thinkers and scholars in philosophy and religious studies and legal studies, political studies and literary studies, who are encouraged and given heart to try their hand and not just do the descriptive interpretive work, which is foundational, of course,
mm-hmm.
but to add their own voices to this enterprise, to this conversation. So that's very exciting to me, and I'm very thrilled to be a part of it.
Before we get into touching on the book, because we're not really going to be able to go into it in incredible amounts of detail in a brief interview, but I wanted to ask you about the book itself. The structure is that it starts with a brief intellectual portrait by Alan Middleman, and the end of the book has a lengthy interview between you and Hava Tirosh Samuelson. But most of the content consists of four essays, one from a journal, one from an edited volume, and two of them are from two of your books. I was wondering you've written a lot, so how did these particular things end up in this honorary
That's
volume?
A great question. Let me say, first of all, that brief essay is, I think, a very remarkable piece of writing. Alan Middleman is the philosopher at Jewish Theological Seminary in New York, and he has paid very close attention to my work. He is one of those people I mentioned who is doing original work in Jewish philosophy himself, in books on Jewish political thinking, on the human, just had one come out this week on human nature, a wonderful classic book he wrote on hope, comparing Jewish and Christian ideas. He's a very good thinker, and it means a lot to me that Alan Middleman has devoted a lot of time. He has followed my work very closely. We tend in this field to read each other's stuff, and he did a beautiful job in that essay. So it's very nice to be able to say here's another philosopher who critically, sympathetically understands what I'm about and is working in his own way on many of these same issues. The interview was a fascinating experience.
Yeah.
Hava Tirosh Samuelson is a very distinguished scholar. Has written about happiness in classical Jewish texts. She wrote a wonderful study of Judah Messer-Leon, a Renaissance humanist who wrote a marvelous book about rhetoric in the Hebrew Bible. We spent 3 hours together.
Wow.
And she also knows my work very well. And one of the inclusions in that collection was definitely under her influence. It was a paper I gave at a conference on Judaism ecology.
Mm.
And Chava and I really hit it off there. We had a funny experience at that conference. It was one of a series of conferences sponsored by Templeton, who was very interested in religion and ecology in different religious traditions. And several of the scholars at that conference looked into the Talmud and so forth and said, oh, there's not much interest in ecology, not much interest in nature and Judaism. And I found myself surprised that I was saying there was quite a lot, and both in the traditional texts and drawing a kind of trajectory from those texts, biblical and Talmudic materials, and classical philosophy materials like Sa'adja and Maimonides, into my own work. One of the distinctive ideas in that theory of justice that I referred to is that it's a general theory of justice. It is not based, like most American theories of justice, on the Lockean idea of a social contract. The problem, one of the problems I find with the social contract idea, which has been picked up and widely popularized in the 20th century by John Rawls, is that it makes justice conventional. And if you don't happen to be a member of the contracting body, whether it's a real historical contract or a virtual contract or a contract that you would have, could have, should have signed onto, you're kind of out in the cold. So you've got a couple of big problems about contractual theories of justice. My idea of justice, in order to make it general, is to make it ontological, that all beings have deserts. And the deserts are proportional to the, or vested in fact, the claims that those beings make upon the environment, upon one another. Those claims may be legitimate or illegitimate, or they may vie with one another, or they not only need to compete, they could complement one another. And the claims of persons, I believe, stand on a kind of moral plateau. They persons have rights and dignities, but animals and plants and echo niches and what I call monuments of nature and culture have deserts as well, and these need to be considered. And one of the big jobs that different cultures have is to work out what the moral relationships are among those different kinds of beings. And Judaism has its own distinctive answers to that question, which go into the general fund of different cultures' ways of dealing with that question. I was able in that conference at Harvard, the one that Templeton sponsored, to talk about the biblical and rabbinic tradition and my own views about the rights and wrongs of things in a way that does include nature and ecology and so forth, without trying to give the vote to the iguana or something like that, I was able to say, there's a right and wrong way to treat animals and echo niches and species and so forth. And that that struck Chava, that struck a resonant note with her, because she's someone who is very committed to nature. And so she very much, when she was putting that series together and that volume, she and Aaron Hughes from Rochester, she was very interested in making sure that that essay was included. Now, there's another of the four pieces that are in the book is my presidential address from the Metaphysical Society. And that develops the metaphysical foundations of that justice theory that I was talking about. I talk about the relationship in that very foundational essay. I talk about the relationship between between being and value, and that again is a very deep theme in Jewish thinking. What one of the most distinctive theses that one can elicit from ancient Jewish texts going all the way back to the beginning, the biblical texts, is the idea of the unity of being and value. And that that has ethical implications. It has theological implications, too. So when I was elected president of the Metaphysical Society of America, I spoke about that in my presidential address, and it was published in the Review of Metaphysics, and I thought it was an appropriate thing to include that essay. A third of the four items that's in the book is a reading of the opening chapters of the Book of Genesis, and it's taken from a book, kind of a biophilosophical book that I wrote called Creation and Evolution,
That was our first interview.
So we could have a cross reference to the other tape. So the chapter in that book, I wanted to show people how to read the Bible without trying to put their scientific knowledge in a strong box someplace, and how to understand the facts about evolution without having to close the book on the Bible. These are not only not in contradiction or in tension with one another, they support one another. That chapter deals with that. I thought it was a good way of representing my interest in the complementarities of science and religion. That's a very important theme. I think for many people, they see an enmity there, or they see a need to compartmentalize. If they have a religious background and a religious commitment, they put that in one part of their thinking, and they try and keep their scientific understanding in another part. And that, I don't find that very healthy, and I don't think it's fair to the science or to the religion. If we understand our scientific work more religiously, and if we understand our religion more scientifically, we'd do a better job with both. I'll give you one example of that. Think about the continuity of which the causal continuity that scientists assume and rely on. They don't think if they fail to find a cause of a particular phenomenon, oh, causality must no longer be working. That kind of constancy is the kind of thing that religious people assign to God. It's a very uncontroversial area of finding an area where God is at work. Lately, I've been involved in a couple of conferences which are concerned with a special divine action. I spoke in Oxford about that, and I will be speaking soon at MIT about that. A lot of people think that when they talk about special divine action, they've got to talk about something very disruptive. How could it be God if it doesn't make a big splash? My thinking is that evolution and emergence are important areas where we can see the hand of God, if you will, at work, without talking about tearing apart the fabric of nature. And what was the fourth one? I got to think about that.
That was another one that dealt with nature. You're talking about the very last essay. That was
That was the final chapter from God of Abraham,
taking on eternalism and some other things.
Yes, I was trying to make a case for the the philosophical values that the idea of creation serves in terms of the endorsement of creativity and newness and discovery. And I was, in some part of that chapter, I was doing battle against a very good philosopher, Charles Hartshorne, for the soul of Bergson. And defending against Hartshorne's criticisms, the idea of creation. So there's another point where you can take the take a traditional biblical idea, which some people understand in a very simple way, and some people feel they can't understand it all, and see that it has a lot of depth to it. And I wanted to explore that, and it's a theme of abiding interest to me. I can say anecdotally, Chris, last year the synagogue that my wife and I belong to, and we're actually both past presidents of it, Cherith Israel here in Nashville, had a kind of a fundraiser around the dedication of a new Sefer Torah, a scroll of the five books of Moses. One was able to purchase, as it were, a verse or a name or a portion of that parchment scroll. And unbeknownst to me, my wife chose the book of Genesis as the part that we wanted to sponsor.
Right.
And the reason she chose it was because she observes the lifelong commitment that I have to taking very seriously the biblical idea of creation. So that that naturally was an appropriate piece to include in the book.
All right. Well, now we're going to actually move in, and you've already kind of moved in a little bit to the substance of each of the chapters. I wanted, and after hearing you talk, I'm thinking my way of dividing the book maybe is a little too simplistic, but the first couple of chapters seem to focus quite a bit on your ontological theory of value.
Sure.
Now, which isn't to say that it doesn't appear in the other chapters, but it seems it pops
up every time I open my eyes.
And then the other two chapters seem to focus more on creation from a couple of different perspectives. So what I wanted to do is ask you a question or two, actually two questions about the first sort of focus, the ontological theory of value, which you've already discussed a little bit, but I want to have you kind of unravel it a little bit more. There is a quote in one of the chapters, which is a nice summary sort of it. At least to me, it seemed like a nice summary of the theory. So I wanted to kind of quote that and then have you unpack it.
Please.
And I do want to mention you use a word several times, connative, and I wanted to just sort of, could you define?
I thought you were going to ask me about whether dessert is spelled with two S's. Because I do have a general theory of desserts.
That's right, one S.
That's very nice.
Because you do use this word connative.
I do, and it's an important theme to me, and it relates to a figure that I often turn to when I feel I need some philosophical help, and that figure is Baruch Spinoza, who is widely respected among Jewish people, but often regarded as the black sheep, and often problematized. He's the he's the non-Jewish Jewish philosopher, or the excommunicated Jewish philosopher or something. One of the chapters that's not included in the book, but I hope people who are interested in these themes and these questions will look at I wrote a long discussion of what's Jewish in Spinoza. Hmm. And Spinoza is a continuator of some of the really important philosophical themes that can be elicited from the Jewish tradition. And he brings those themes into a modern setting, and one that takes nature and science very seriously. And I'm making an adjective out of a term that Spinoza uses a lot, and very critically in his philosophy, which is conatus. Mm. Conatus in Latin means striving. And when Spinoza engages in metaphysics, and we should tell people who are listening to this conversation that metaphysics is the science of being as such. What do we know? Aristotle defined it. Aristotle said, what do we know about reality? What do we know about things just in virtue of the fact that they are? You know, if you're a veterinarian, you can study animals, and if you're a botanist, you can study plants. But what do we know about things in general, in the most general way, just in virtue of their being? And the idea that Aristotle developed from that was the idea of essence. We often talk about the essence of things. What is it really to be that kind of a thing? Spinoza wanted to redefine the idea of essence. Over the centuries, people had gotten the idea that essences are static, and they had gotten the idea that essences are very general, so general that maybe they ought to be treated as abstractions because they're universals, and universals only exist in people's minds, or so it was thought by a lot of people. So the word essence was misleading in a way. Spinoza believed that the essences of all things, so what everything has in common, insofar as it is at all, are not static but dynamic, even to the extent that there's room there for evolution, for example. The nature of a species can change, and it's no longer that species. The lineage has become something else. We know now, something Spinoza didn't know, the dinosaurs didn't die out. Some of them survived as birds. They don't look like dinosaurs anymore. They're not reptiles. They are indeed warm-blooded. And they have feathers. Not fur, not scales. They have a nature, but the nature is not fixed. And further, the idea of essences, as I say, often was thought of in universal terms. And Spinoza thought that every individual could have its own essence. We could even say, in the case of persons, his or her own essence. Your essence is your project, to put it in 20th century terms. The essence of a being is what it's about, what it's after, what it's striving to attain or achieve. And that's where the conative comes in. Mm-hmm. The conatus of a thing is its essence as that particular being, not fixed in time, but striving to become what it can become, trying to seek and grope and figure out. And, of course, essences differ a lot if you're going to use this notion to cover all reality. They're going to be living beings and non-living beings. Mm. None of them are inert. Mm-hmm. All of them are actively expressing their own character. And living beings try to define their own environment. Persons try to define their own character and choose their own purposes, sometimes well, sometimes badly. But we have a project, to some extent, self-made. So that conative idea is talking about what is dynamic in things and what is goal-oriented in beings. Where do those goals come from? Now, why that's important in the general theory of desserts is that studying the demands that beings make upon their environment, upon one another, upon themselves, gives you your first inkling of what their desserts are. You could call those, I think, prima facie desserts, because, as I said before, they could conflict with one another, and then we have to work out how those conflicts should be dealt with. I don't think conflict is the big theme of life or of reality. I think there are other big themes which are much more interesting than like collaboration, for example, or symbiosis or cooperation. Big theme in the Hebrew Bible is chesed. I'm writing a book right now called Judaism, a Contemporary Philosophical Investigation. I'm sure we'll be talking about it next year. And one of the themes that emerges from that book is the idea of chesed, which is often translated as loving kindness. It's interesting that it's the term for God's grace in the Hebrew Bible, and it's also the term for piety that human beings feel towards God, which is a kind of way of returning that grace, and the generosity and love and favor that human beings can show to one another. So these are important themes. But what elicits chesed is the conative characters of things. That's where the caring is directed. So the conative is something that we can observe, that we mustn't overlook, and it has tremendous ethical implications.
In some ways, and you've covered the quote. I was going to quote, so I'll go ahead and
no, go ahead. Maybe it sums up what I was saying.
Yes. So you say, and it's really a packed quote. So in some ways, you've kind of unpacked it to a degree. You say, value, as I see it, is not a proper property supervenient on the being of things. It is their being and the project of their being. So
yes.
That's what you were saying.
Yes.
I see value in the very existence of things because that existence is dynamic and conative. Beings make claims, and those claims establish prima facie desserts. And that's what you were saying
yes.
earlier. So this is sort of like the base level. That's what I'm understanding.
Well, the
sort of
prima facie desserts are the base level, yeah. and then we've got to work out
right.
what the legitimate desserts would
and that's
be.
That's where you say the equilibration of such claims in relation to each other lays out the basis of the actual desserts, of actual
right,
desserts.
Right.
In the resultant hierarchy, persons, by dint of their subjecthood, reach a moral plateau that grounds human worth and dignity, existential rights, and equality. So that's...
Yes.
Quoting
yes.
you.
Thank you. I won't disagree with it. But let me pick up on one
yeah.
little thing that happened at the beginning of that
yeah.
Passage that you quoted. I used that term supervenient, and
right.
I said that value is not a sort of a property of things that is supervenient upon the things. It is
right.
it is the being of those things. That's why the Chronotis is so important, because the Chronotis is the being of those things. It's not static. It's not general. It's very much existential and dynamic. But I was also in that line when I said it's not a property. I was sort of taking a swipe at a problem that some philosophers of the last century, I don't want to say they were dealing with it. They were sort of looking askance at it. There was a lot of discussion about whether value was a natural property or a non-natural property. Now, if it's a natural property, it sounds like value is just a matter of value could be identified with pleasure or utility or... you could get some kind of an ammeter to attach and measure how many benthams of pleasure a given activity would generate. That seems paradoxical, and there are classic arguments to refute that kind of ethical naturalism, that kind of reductionism. Mm. On the other hand, if you go to the other end of the spectrum and say, oh, well, it's not a natural property. Okay, so what is it? A non-natural property? You're talking about something spooky then, something, you know, you say you're being ethical and it sounds like you're being superstitious, save it for Halloween. No. What I'm saying is they're barking up the wrong tree. It's not a property at all. Value is the being of things. What's valuable about the dog or the cat or the person or the mountain or the echo niche or the monuments of culture that the ISIS people are destroying? Mm-hmm. That value is there. That value is that thing. Mm. It's not something else. Mm-hmm. That value is that person. That's what's valuable there. It's not something about the person. It is the person. Mm. You know, this famous line about Wittgenstein about how to get the fly out of the fly bottle. Well, first let's find out how the fly got into the fly bottle. And in this case, the way the fly got into the fly bottle is by saying, okay, well, value must be either a natural property or a non-natural property. And both ways have tremendous problems associated with them. And I think the problem comes from looking for the wrong sort of thing when they're looking for value. And this is one example of Jewish philosophy coming up with a different perspective and saying, well, you know, that whole tradition, which thinks that it's so white bread that it must be universal, it's just one particular tradition, which has gone off onto a kind of a branch, which got narrower and narrower and thinner until it's become a twig, and sometimes the twig breaks, and you got to go back to the main body of the tree and see where the real issue lies. It's a tremendous value for comparative philosophy. It's not unique to Jewish philosophy. You can do this by looking at Chinese philosophy or Indian philosophy. I spend a lot of time studying Islamic philosophy, which is related to Western philosophy, but has taken a different turn. And sometimes it's taken a good turn, sometimes it's taken a bad turn. We can learn by studying comparative philosophy. Jewish philosophy, by identifying being with value, as I claim that it does, has something really major, not just ornamental, not just a slightly different slant, really major contribution there to make.
You've mentioned in some earlier comments in sort of talking about the variety of different beings that have value, a list. I mean, and you give kind of a list that occurs several times. In particularly in one of the chapters of the book, these are beings, animals, plants, humans, mountains, rivers, species, ecosystems, works of art, institutions, memories, traditions, sciences, ideas, planets, galaxies. And I assume that's not an exhaustive list, but I do wonder, are there things that aren't beings? I in trying to grasp this concept of being, I think, for example, I'm recording you on a computer. Is that a being? All of the objects around me, do they all have sort of a conatus?
First of all, yeah, sure. The computer is a being. Mm-hmm. You're not going to say. It doesn't exist. If it exists, it's a being.
Okay.
Does it have desserts? Yeah, I think it does. There's a wonderful commandment, mitzvah, that the rabbis derive from the Torah. And this is the kind of digging that one does when one takes the tradition seriously. There's a commandment in the Torah that if you're besieging a city, you're not supposed to destroy the fruit trees.
Mm-hmm.
And the rabbis generalized that into a principle of Baal Tashchit. Don't be wantonly destructive. Don't just destroy things. For example, when you get buried, you're not supposed to get buried in fancy clothes because that's a kind of waste. It's not just a sumptuary law like don't do everything too fancy. It's a law about wastefulness. Mm. If somebody takes a baseball bat to the computer, mm-hmm. that's a destructive act. Now, does the computer have desserts? Mm. Up to a point. Desserts are relative in my account until mm-hmm. you get to persons.
Mm-hmm.
Persons have rights. If we needed to do something to the computer to save somebody's life, we wouldn't hesitate to do it. Persons aren't on the same plane
mm-hmm.
as things. Animals aren't on the same plane as persons, in my view. I think it's bad rhetoric to talk about animal rights. Animals have desserts. We shouldn't needlessly cause harm or pain to them. But if we need to do medical experimentation to save people's lives from cancer, we can establish priorities and say how far we can go. And I think that's an appropriate thing for us to inquire into and work on and do something about. A part of your question is a kind of challenge. What would not count as a thing?
Yes, there is. Or a being, I guess. Yes.
Well, or a being.
Yes.
Fair enough.
Yeah.
The properties of things are not beings.
Mm-hmm.
So you're wearing a nice dark purple shirt. the purpleness of your shirt is not a being.
Mm-hmm.
The character of your shirt, in a way, is invested in that purpleness,
right?
And there may be something worth preserving there. Think about a text, because I mentioned as you brought out
mm-hmm.
Certain artifacts. I say monuments of nature mm-hmm. and monuments of culture. By monuments of nature, I had the interview with Chava in her campus at Arizona State, and they're surrounded mm. by monuments of nature. There are saguaro cactuses, and there are beautiful mountains and mesas and rock formations. It's no mystery to someone who opens his or her eyes and looks out there. There's a lot of things out there mm. that are worth preserving because of what they are. It's not something that's readily captured by contractual theories of justice,
mm-hmm.
but our laws actually do try to protect some of those things. We have areas in this country which are called wilderness areas, and they're not national parks. They're not places where you can go for entertainment or boating and kayaking and hunting and fishing. There are places where we think that these things should be preserved for the sake of their intrinsic value.
Mm.
We talk about species diversity and trying not to eliminate species wholesale. Try to preserve the species of animals and plants that are on Earth. Not even just animals and plants. I remember when my wife and I took my eldest grandson to Yellowstone, we saw volcanic areas, the hot water bubbling up, and there are certain species of bacteria that live in those volcanic pools. The pools are very, very hot, and the bacteria assort themselves by how much heat they can stand. And they have different colors. So you see rings of yellow, green, orange bacteria all organized according to the varying degrees of heat that are coming out of that bubbling hot water. those things are protected. Those are protected species. Mm-hmm. Somebody recognizes that those are such a remarkable thing in their conatus. They're striving. They're trying to stay alive. There's something special. There's something distinctive about them that is worth preserving. Not because we ever might make use of them. Mm. I don't think any of them are likely. I had a friend who was a botanist, two pair of friends in botanists in Hawaii who thought that some of these bacteria could be useful. But we don't preserve them just because they might be useful. Mm-hmm. We preserve them because of what they are. Mm. Not because they're beautiful. Not because they're higher life forms. They're lower life forms. They're bacteria. Their existence makes a claim on us. Mm-hmm. The Jewish philosopher of the last century, Levinas, says that the human face makes a claim. He invests that idea of the face. He uses the face as a kind of an emblem or a symbol or a spokesperson of personhood. He's speaking as somebody who survived the Holocaust and he survived because he was a POW. All his family was destroyed. He talks about the claim that a face makes. Mm. So I say persons make a very special kind of claim. I wrote a book, one of my Islamic things, which is not featured in the book about Jewish philosophy. I wrote a book about Islamic humanism. And in the opening of that book, I was writing the preface to that book just at the time when we got the word of the destruction of the Buddhas at Bamiyan. Mm. These are achievements. They're monuments of culture. One doesn't have to be a Buddhist to respect what those figures represent in terms of art, in terms of labor, in terms of human caring, in terms of trying to define an idea of sanctity. It's a very wide, and it's meant to be a very wide, a very universal mm-hmm. kind of idea of desserts, an idea of justice. Mm-hmm. Let me put a point on it. When I spoke about contractual theories leaving people out, people, the unborn, future generations, people from the past, who are greatly respected in traditional societies, but often neglected in very modern societies. Fetuses, the people who are very ill or comatose, they all have desserts because of what they might become, because of what they have been. That has to be regarded. Even if they can't sign a contract, even if they can't contribute any longer or yet, we're not morally so pragmatic that we have to only care about everybody pulling his oar.
Hmm. Yeah. Well, this actually might be a good time to kind of jump ahead in a question, at least one question. I was going to turn to creation, but I think I'm going to ask you about God.
Okay.
And I'm following Hava Tirosh Samuelson and her exchange with you about God in the interview where she asks you, in particular, some questions about the personhood of God. So I wanted to ask you, in your view, who or what is God? Is God being? Is God beyond being, other than being?
Well, that's
it. Seemed like
one.
It seemed like you were. My reading of the interview was that you were kind of not exactly struggling with the question, but it's a question that's very present with you. And
well,
I think
everyone who's serious about religion does mm-hmm. struggle with that question. And
yeah.
I don't think there's anything wrong with that.
No.
You know, the official name of the Jewish people is Yisrael,
mm-hmm.
Israel, which means the one who struggles with God, as the Bible defines it. One of the things that one has to do to be a serious philosopher, who is a Jewish philosopher, is to struggle with that kind of question. So let me start by saying it's something I work with, and I don't expect to be finished, to have exhausted that question. That's not the way that kind of question works. I do think that God is a being. I think that God is a very special kind of being. Maimonides, who is very close to my heart and a philosopher, as I think you know, Chris, I'm
right.
A colleague and I are translating The Guide to the Perplexed now. We're writing a commentary on it. Maimonides is says that God has a kind of being that's different from the kind of being that every other being has. So if you're talking about a being that's unique, that doesn't fit under a category, that isn't readily defined, that's kind of special. In my book, God of Abraham, one of the things that comes out there is that one of the things that's distinctive about the being of God is that all the beings we know are determinate and are therefore contingent. That means they have a definite nature and they don't have, they might have been otherwise, they might not have existed at all, they depend on their causes, they depend on one another. God, in Spinoza's language, is his own cause, causa sui. Doesn't depend on anything else, everything else depends on him. When you talk about a necessary being, you're talking about something unique. You're talking about something that that doesn't get explained, doesn't get analyzed, doesn't get taken apart, doesn't get attributed to some other cause. God doesn't have a father and mother. So that uniqueness is very important, and that ontological primacy is very important. Another thing that's worth quoting from Maimonides, and I did quote it in my conversation with Chava, is Maimonides says that even little children should be taught that God is not a person. And what he meant by saying that is, don't think you can chaffer and deal with God. Don't think you can bribe God. Don't think you can influence God. God's transcendence is very, very big. The idea that God is infinite is very important. One of the things I mentioned an interest in trying to work out thoughts about how we can understand divine action. Another interest, which I haven't really probed as fully as I want to, but I've touched on it a little bit lately, is how we can think of God's knowledge. And one thought I've come up with there is that, you know, I wrote this book about human consciousness along with a friend of mine, Greg Caramenico.
Another interview.
You also interviewed me about that. And one of the things that's distinctive about human consciousness is that it foregrounds and backgrounds. We focus. We try and focus anyway. If God is infinite, then divine knowledge doesn't foreground and background. It doesn't focus. It's everywhere about everything. And I don't think people have fully worked out what that could mean. I think it's philosophically important to understand that idea. There's a kind of a gag that gets at it a little bit if you think about knowledge in relation to providence and caring. The person who stands there and looks at God and says, "God, you help total strangers. Why don't you help me?" And that thought that God's agency and God's knowledge are universal. It's related to an idea in Spinoza. We talked about Conatus. I think it's very interesting that in one of his works, Spinoza defines providence as Conatus.
Hmm.
You want to see God? You can see God in the striving of all things.
Hmm.
Now, that's, as I read it, not a reductive remark. It's not saying God is just the laws of nature or something like that. And that's what Chava was probing. She wanted to see, are you reducing God to some mere principle,
mm-hmm.
or was part of her concern.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And on the contrary, I don't think I am. When you talk about infinite perfection, that's something I will have to talk about in December in Jerusalem. There'll be a conference of people who do Jewish philosophy, organized by my friend Yoram Chazoni, who has a new institute there, the Herzl Institute. They're going to be having a conference. Chazoni is very worried about the idea of perfect being theology. And perfect being theology is something that some sort of logicist-minded philosophical theologians have gotten into. And I think Chazoni has a good reason to worry about it a little bit, because they kind of try to make God into a set of rules.
Mm-hmm.
Chazoni wants to go back to what he finds in the Bible, where God is far from being a set of rules. But when I go to Jerusalem on that conference, I'm going to try and defend the idea of perfect being theology, not as those sort of overly neat, logical-minded guys do, but not doing away with the idea of God's absoluteness.
Mm.
Not doing away. I don't want to get to the notion that God changes his mind.
Mm.
That God can be influenced, etc. If you read the Bible very literally, then in the story of Noah, it tells you that God was really sorry he'd gotten started with these humans. I don't read the Bible very literally, and I think that story is there to teach us a lesson. I don't think it's something that happened historically. I don't think that's the purpose of the story. I don't have to worry. We talked about this one time. About who cleaned up after all the animals on the ark. So I take that sentence about God really regretting that he had made humans. I take that to be a form of poetry, and one of the things one tries to do in Jewish philosophy is to resolve that poetry where one can and figure out what it's trying to teach us. Oftentimes, as in that case, it's trying to teach us something about ourselves.
Hmm.
Are we the kind of beings? This is a question we have to ask ourselves. Now, the question to ask yourself is not who cleaned up after the animals in the ark. The question to ask yourself is, are we the kind of beings that would make God really sorry he'd ever gotten started with us? That's a question worth asking.
Hmm.
And when you use the expression about God feeling sorry that he'd never gotten started with us, you begin to see that feeling sorry is as much a misnomer when applied to God as gender language is. I say he because I don't want to say it, because it sounds, if you say it, it sounds like you're reducing God to a set of rules, you know. But person? Not exactly. No, I don't think so. Being, yes, but a unique and special kind of being. There's a great philosopher of the 3rd century, Plotinus, the founder of Neoplatonism, who made it acceptable, which it hadn't been in Greek before, to talk about God as something infinite. And I think we're still working out what that could mean.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, actually, several things that you've said provide a nice segue into the question I had about what I'm calling the creation part of the book.
Okay.
I mean, you talked about contingency, you talked about perfectionism, and I think you take up some of those topics in these two chapters. The one, which is a commentary on the early part of Genesis, and the other, philosophical debate, where you are arguing strongly that, you know, we should be talking about a creation, not an of the world, not an eternalism.
Mm-hmm.
Notion, and God as a separate being from the world,
mm-hmm.
Rather than the cosmic anthropic principle that mm-hmm. you contest. So, what are the implications, as you see it, of your position about creation, the importance of creation, the importance of a God separate from the world, as against those of the opinions, the arguments that you're contesting? You know, what are the implications of yours as opposed to theirs? And also, how do the creation accounts inform the philosophical argument that you're making?
Okay. First of all, separate from the world worries me a little.
Okay.
Transcendent, yes, but one of the points I'm bringing out in Judaism and philosophical, contemporary philosophical investigation, is that in Jewish thinking, transcendence does not negate or exclude immanence.
Mm.
So separate in the sense of exiled and apart and unapproachable,
right.
Not there.
Right.
That's not where I want to go. And there's a wonderful proof text for that in Isaiah, which is used heavily liturgically by Jews and non-Jews alike. And the text from Isaiah is, "Holy, holy, holy, the Lord of hosts, the fill of all the earth is his glory." Idea, Isaiah 6:4 or 6:5. You can look it up. People can look it up.
That's right.
That if you understand that holy means set apart,
mm-hmm.
as you can derive from studying its appearance in the text, that's the prophet's term for transcendence.
That's the set apartness you're talking
that's
about.
That's the set apartness,
yeah.
And the idea of repeating holy like that, I think it places God higher and higher and higher, powers above the world. And what that means to me is that God is not reducible to the world.
Mm.
God is not just a thing in the world. But then the other hemistich in that ecstatic line, Miloko ha'aretz kavodo, his glory, they usually translate it, his glory fills the world. But strictly translated, it says the fill of all the earth is his glory. Miloko ha'aretz kavodo, the fill of all the earth is his glory. That means if glory, as I read it, is the manifestation of God, that would we can apprehend of God. The manifestation of God is the fill of all the world.
Mm-hmm.
Connect that to that account of metaphysics that I was given before. All these things are expressions of God. All these things are very special. The varying degrees of how special they are, and I certainly am not going to say that everything deserves to be loved. There are some nasties out there, which are perversions of the holiness that was given to them. So don't misunderstand me there.
Mm-hmm.
But we've got in one experiential, prophetic, poetic line from Isaiah, we've got the combination of the transcendent and the immanent.
Mm.
And I think that that's a very important theme. And it's one that some of the Greek philosophers were very interested in. I mentioned Plotinus already and his great philosopher that he followed, Plato, thought in those terms. And it's a very important and much thought about theme in Jewish sources. It's easy to see how that idea of God's transcendence manifesting itself so that the infinite is expressed in the finite and determinate is connected to the idea of creation. That's what creation amounts to. Mention Maimonides. Maimonides has the thought derived from something it says in the Talmud, that there are two really big problems, two really big philosophical problems about the Torah, or in the Torah. One is the problem of creation, and one is the problem of theophany. Problem of creation gets the code name Maaseh Bereishit, which means the account of creation as given in Genesis.
Hmm.
And the other, Maaseh Merkava. Maaseh Merkava, literally the account of the chariot, which is a reference to Ezekiel's vision of a chariot, which was for the rabbis a kind of a scandal, because here's this prophet that we recognize and respect as an inspired spokesperson of God, and he claims to have seen God, which we don't believe is possible. What's going on here? So we got a mystery here. Now, those two problems are really of a piece with one another. God's manifestation of himself in finite terms, there's a disproportion there, the infinite manifesting itself in the determinate. Theophany could be regarded as a special case of that. How could it be that my finite mind can encounter God in any way? When I'm this little guy with a finite lifespan and a finite experience and very finite knowledge, and I'm going to encounter the infinite. Sometimes that's understood in terms of revelation in Jewish terms, in terms of the specification of God's demands. We have these commandments. Why these commandments? Why not different commandments? Why this way? Why not that way? And so we struggle to figure out how to interpret these commandments as expressions of a love of God and a way of connecting with God. We say that by being good people and by studying nature and trying to understand nature as a manifestation of God's wisdom and God's grace, that we can indirectly apprehend, make contact with God, but we do so in a very, very limited way. We're again using the finite as though we could, you know, we're standing on this little tiny stepladder, and we're trying to use that to climb to distant galaxies, which wouldn't be far enough. Yet we think we can do that kind of thing. in a small way. When we understand nature the right way, when we understand human goodness the right way, we can touch God in a way and be touched by God. So the immanent and the transcendent connect at a point. And the name of that point, biblically, is the human heart. And that's why a prophetic poet will say, it's nice to translate it politely, open your heart. But that sounds like a Hallmark card. What it really says, literally, is circumcise your heart. The idea is, the heart, of course, as Bible scholars know, is not just the seat of the emotions, but the seat of the understanding. And we think, and understanding in this context doesn't divorce itself from love and caring. It is at one with love and caring, which is one of the reasons why its seat is the heart. So that's another one of these distinctive insights. You know, there's been too much of a bifurcation between loving and knowing in a lot of Western philosophy. Jewish texts don't make that distinction. And that's something wholesome to get a hold of. But that point of intersection of the infinite with the finite is very important to us. And that's where the transcendent becomes immanent, and the determinate reaches beyond itself.
Mm-hmm. In this last question, I kind of wanted to turn back to the whole issue of Jewish philosophy and Jewish philosophers, and again pick up on your discussion with Tirosh Samuelson. You talk at one point about the difference between philosophers and dogmatic theologians. Mm-hmm. And you note that religious philosophers, and you use Locke as an example, may be interested in making their religious tradition defensible, but unlike dogmatic theologians, they're willing to change their tradition in order to make it defensible. And then you say a little bit later, in the conversation, quote, "I don't think we operate simply within a tradition, but rather with a tradition, or part of a tradition," unquote. So I wonder if you could talk a little bit about the limit points, if there are any, for Jewish philosophers vis-a-vis Judaism, and whether it is, and here I'm quoting, I think I'm quoting Tirosh Samuelson, "possible for the Jewish philosopher to do philosophical work without any reference to the sacred text." And I know you, unquote, and I know you say it would be foolish for such a thing to happen, and obviously you do plenty of work in which you're working with biblical and rabbinic texts. But is it, I guess, sort of another limit question. Is it possible for somebody to claim that they're a Jewish philosopher yet kind of not work with... with those texts?
Okay.
So it's basically just sort of a, you know, what are the limits to being a Jewish
philosopher? Sure. one of the advantages of studying those texts is that as one studies them, one learns how to answer that question. And I'll tell you specifically what one can learn that way.
Okay.
There's a continuity in the tradition.
Mm-hmm.
The tradition grows and changes. Those who form the tradition learn from their own experience and from the experience of others. One of the things it says in Mishnah Avot, who is wise? He who learns from everyone. If you don't have that kind of an open mind, if you circle the wagons and close your mind, you not only become unwise, you become crabbed and brittle and eventually sort of dry up and blow away. But the continuity works this way. As you absorb the great themes of the tradition, which are textually manifested because this is a literate culture with, a lot of stuff to study, what you see is the way the continuity works is that the way change occurs in order to keep the tradition a living tradition is not radical. It is the opposite of radical is not gradual, although change is gradual in any historical circumstance. But when something doesn't really fit, when something doesn't really work, the whole body of tradition comes to bear and is brought to bear against it. And it gets extruded. Give you an example. I'll give you a couple of examples of that. Slavery. Tolerated in biblical times. You can see the Torah trying to regulate it, saying people shouldn't be slaves permanently unless they want to be, and providing a method for that to happen. Runaway slaves can't be returned to their owner. That's, 1850, they could be on the Fugitive Slave Act in this country. No, biblically, fugitive slaves can't be returned to their owner. So you have an effort to regulate slavery, but it's still tolerated. You have regulations about if you injure your slave, there are consequences for you. Polygamy, definitely tolerated in patriarchal times, biblical times. Both of them eventually eliminated, no longer considered tolerable. In the case of polygamy, there was a takana, Rabbi Gershom, a famous takana, a decree banning polygamy. Can't happen. We don't practice slavery anymore. The way that happens, in the case of polygamy, the large model of biblical thinking about marital relations squeezes out that practice. It was a social practice that was tolerated. We can see some of that kind of change happening within the Bible itself. Levirate marriage is a good example. Levirate marriage was originally an obligation. It became an obligation that you could waive. Ultimately, it became an obligation that you were expected to waive. That's an interesting kind of a change. But in biblical times, it was already an obligation that you could waive. That's a very interesting kind of thing where the main body of the tradition is brought to bear to change things. And I raise that as an example in response to your question because I think if one is a philosopher working with those texts, one of the things that philosophers can do, and analytic philosophers are not always very good at it, one of the things philosophers can do is thematize a tradition. What are the really big issues? What are the really big claims? What are the really big beliefs? What are the really big norms and values of the tradition? And what do those have to say about the outliers and the exceptional situations, and how do we judge this, and how do we deal with that? And the rabbis are very, very good at that. There's a provision in the Bible that you have to take a parapet on your roof so there won't be a disaster of somebody falling off. This is in a society where people used to, they didn't have air conditioning, but they went to go up on the roof to try and cool off. That particular piece of legislation becomes a basis about making precautions and what counts as negligence and so forth. You thematize these things. The rabbis did this all the time. They were good at it. And similarly, with regard to these more theoretical issues that philosophers are concerned with. Philosophers are concerned with practical issues too, of course, but working within the tradition, one isn't just carping at it from the outside or picking at it. One is talking about what needs to be done. I would like to see more of that kind of thing happening in Islam. Islam is having some real serious problems today. It's causing some problems for the rest of the world, but it's having some problems, which Islamic theologians and jurists are failing to deal with. Partly because every time somebody does try to deal with them, they get zapped. We have to have our own internal, committed, loyal, organically connected maintainers of a kind of continuity, which makes a religious tradition, a cultural tradition, capable of growth and adjustment and development. Try and do it radically. You create something that's destructive and imaginary, and usually fails. So philosophers can have an important role, but philosophers who see themselves as outsiders and feel alienated and don't know how to work with the tradition and don't even know what's in the tradition, we got a lot of people in this country or in this world who don't know what the Bible says, including a lot of professional people, academics. No idea what's in there. Working with that knowledge, one can. Working in a vacuum, without that knowledge, one isn't even addressing the people who are concerned, let alone the problems that they might face. I think it's critical to work in that way. I think that's part of what a Jewish philosopher does. A Jewish philosopher has to represent that tradition to non-Jews and explain it, help them in their quest to understand those values and how they interact and interface with their own cultures and traditions and customs and whether they have anything to learn from us. But a Jewish philosopher also has to be addressing Jewish people and showing them how to solve the philosophical problems that they face, whether it's the problem of evil or whether it's the problem of some ethical problem or some applied ethics problem. That's part of our job. Philosophers in general can and should be doing very practical work, being very useful to people, because people face philosophical problems all the time and don't have the tools with which to address them. And Jewish philosophers have that kind of a role vis-a-vis Judaism and vis-a-vis the rest of the world as well.
Thank you, Len. Thank you again for
well, it was a great pleasure, Chris,
to talk to me. I've been talking with Len Goodman, professor of philosophy and Andrew W. Mellon professor in the humanities, about the recent book honoring him, Len E. Goodman, Judaism, Humanity, and Nature, edited by Hava Tarosh Samuelson and Aaron W. Hughes. And as I said earlier, the book's part of the series The Library of Contemporary Jewish Philosophers, published by Brill. If you have any comments about this conversation, just browse to the homepage of the Vanderbilt Divinity Library and click on the Ask a Librarian link on that page. We look forward to hearing from you, and thanks for listening.
Thank you.